The reason people aren't financially free is they don't know what to do and they don't know where to start. I want you to join Joey and I at the Virtual Inner Circle Live, April the 4th through the 6th, as we share with you the exact answers to those questions. We only do this event one time per year. I don't want you to miss out. Go to wealthwalkwallstreet.com/live and enter promo code podcast. When you're at this event, you're going to get your investor DNA. You're going to get access to up to 6 different passive income strategies. So you know, leaving this event, exactly what to do, taking our decades of knowledge so that you can start becoming financially free. Go to wealthwalkwallstreet.com/live and enter the promo code podcast.
Russ, did I ever tell you the time I was in Buffalo, New York at my grandparents' house one summer and I had the greatest hit of my life?
A hit like a record?
Baseball? No, baseball. Baseball. Oh, like I would, okay. This is the prime of my baseball career when I was like 10, 11, 12. I was just crushing balls.
Okay.
So I'm in the side yard. Picture this. Their house is on this corner and there's a big side yard. And it's a, I mean, this is a 100-year-old house at that time. It's super old now. And it's just this clear path. Me and my cousins are out there playing baseball. And it looks like the sand lot, but, you know, Buffalo, New York. They've got the windows open in the kitchen to kind of keep eyes on us and everything. And I hit this just massive shot and it goes careening through their kitchen windows. Bang! Just crashed, like just shatters the whole thing. And it was one of those moments that I was like, I was so excited about something. It was like, this was success. And then it was total regret immediately. Like, oh my Lord, what have I done? And I was expecting people to come out like cussing, whatever. And I'll tell you this, my grandfather came out and he was so humble and so gracious. I didn't even have to pay for anything. They took care of it. But man, immediately I was like,
pay for it with like your bottle cap money?
Dude, I was, you know, I was a saver. Come on.
At 10?
I was crushing it, man. I've always been a saver. Get out of here.
At 10?
Oh. How many? Where do you think all that birthday money went? Christmas money? I mean, I was saving that, socking it away like a freaking chicken.
Well, you only had 10 birthdays. My guess is you probably didn't get a whole lot until you're like 6 or 7. I mean, okay, I'm sorry to be busting your story up.
What's all I'm saying is it went from immediate success to immediate regret, and it just reminded me of our interview here with Jay Scott. You know, Jay has been ridiculously successful in real estate. He's done over 400 flips in his career. Now he's getting into multifamily and several other projects he talks about in the show, but he talks about regret and how the biggest cost in his whole career and his lifetime has been not holding on to some of those flips and turning them into cash flowing real estate that would have been more passive.
Well, and I, so I would anyway, say just, the big, I would say the biggest regret in that story was thinking short range instead of long range, which one of our mentors, Nelson Nash, always told us we've got to think
long
70 range. Years down the road.
Yes.
And I think too oftentimes we get too caught up in the here and now, and that causes plenty of issues and consequences for down the road. And I think that that's the regret story that I got from it. And I want you to listen to this, see what you take away from it. Let's jump in our interview right now with Jay Scott.
Welcome to the Wealth Without Wall Street podcast, your guide to understanding how to get out of the Wall Street rat race and start your own mailbox money lifestyle. Now, don't let these handsome Southern draws fool you. These financial minds are teaching our country to enhance savings, increase cash flow, and create passive income, all without the help of Wall Street. Are you ready to break through? Now here are your hosts, Russ Morgan and Joey Murray.
Welcome into the show. If you have been in or around the real estate world, the bigger pockets world even, you know this name, but man, we are so grateful to have Jay Scott on the show today. Jay, welcome.
Thanks. Appreciate you guys having me.
Well, Jay, you've talked a lot with us on the kind of off record here, and what Joey and I have learned that we could sit down and probably spend days, if not weeks, with you to pull out all the nuggets of information you have, but we don't have that amount of time. So for those of those who have not listened to Bigger Pockets, haven't heard you before, hadn't read any of your books, you mentioned to us that you got your start in house flipping, but over the years, you've realized how much money that cost you. I would love to have you kind of talk about your past and then why it was so expensive to learn that lesson.
Yeah. So I started in the corporate world. So I did the engineering thing and the business thing, and I went the tech route and did the Silicon Valley thing. And then 2008, my wife and I decided to get married and realized that the 80-hour work weeks and the traveling 3-4 weeks a month just wasn't going to work for us, because we really wanted to start a family. We were getting older. We were in our mid to late 30s at that point. And so we said, we need to figure something else out. So long story short, we quit our jobs, moved across the country, got married in August of 2008. And not that interesting a story, but we accidentally fell into kind of flipping houses. My wife was watching an HGTV show, said, hey, let's try that. So we flipped a house, and then we flipped a second house and a third and a fifth and a tenth. And before we knew it, we were house flippers. Like, we never quite figured out what that next thing was going to be because we fell into real estate. And so by 2011, we were flipping about 40 or 50 houses a year. I sat down. It was interesting. I still think back to this a lot. Back in 2008, when I first got started, I invited a guy who was flipping houses in my area, also owned some rentals in my area. I invited him out to lunch just because I wanted to pick his brain. And one of the questions, you know, you always ask when you take somebody out, is so if you could do it all over again, what would you do differently? What was the biggest mistake you've made? And he didn't have to think about it. I mean, emphatically, he was biggest mistake I've ever made in this business was every house I've ever sold. He's like, I regret every flip I ever sold. I regret it. And I was making money at this point, flipping houses. We had done a couple at that point, making 20, 30, 40,000 a flip. And I'm thinking, I don't know how I'm ever going to regret this. So I remember him saying it, but I didn't really think about it. Here we are 13 years later. I've done 400 and some flips. And if anybody were to take me out to lunch right now and say, what's the biggest regret I have in this business? Literally the biggest regret I have in this business is every house I've ever sold. So I sat down 6 or 8 months ago, I don't remember exactly when it was, and my wife and I just kind of went through and we just did a ballpark of how much the houses we flipped have appreciated over the years. And what we've realized is we've left like $30 to $40 million on the table by selling all those deals. Now, I'm not saying I could have held every one. I couldn't have afforded to hold 400 deals, but if I would have done what I used to tell other people to do, which is you buy two and hold one, or buy three and hold one, I'd have another 50, 100, 150 houses right now, and I'd likely have another $10 million in the bank. So certainly the biggest lesson I've learned in this business has been don't just go the transactional route. Hold for long-term appreciation, for principal pay down, for cash flow, lots of good reasons to hold on to properties. And I just wish I would have realized that a decade sooner.
It's super insightful. All right, I got a couple of probably not very insightful questions I'm going to ask just because it came to my brain, and that's usually the way I think. Here's one of the questions I have, and we've not asked. Of course, everybody who's come on the show that has been in real estate either has a wholesaling background or a flipping background. That just seems to be the entree into it. And the thought that I just had is, has the house flipping market gotten so saturated that someone who is trying to get their start would be at a disadvantage to do it now? Or do you think it's just as opportunistic today as it was when you started in it in 2008?
So I get this question a lot. And what I like to say is there's no bad time to get into real estate, but there's certainly a bad time to get into certain niches within real estate. And house flipping tends to work well if the market is flat or going up. House flipping doesn't work well when the market's going down. So right now, the market's not going down. It's going up. And for as long as it continues to go up, or at least continues to be flat, it's going to be a good time to flip houses. Question is, how much longer is the market going to go up? It could be another 6 months. It could be another 6 years. It could be another 10 years. We don't know. And none of us has a crystal ball. I predicted a recession back in 2017. Not when I say I predicted it, I mean, we're all just guessing. But I really expected that 2018, 2019, we would see an economic downturn, not what we saw related to COVID, but one that was just more natural. When it didn't come, I had to start rethinking like all my ideas around economics and economic cycles. And what I'm realizing is that, yeah, there's a good quote. I love this quote. It's the market can stay irrational longer than you can stay solvent. And it really goes to the point that, yeah, you can think there's a downturn coming and you can change all your strategies for it, but the market is going to react the way the market's going to react. And unless we look back in hindsight, we never really know what the market's going to look like. So going to your question, is now a good time to flip houses? If you think the market's going to stay flat or continue to go up for the next several years, now's a great time to flip houses. Always is. But if you're concerned about the market turning down, if you're concerned about any type of recessionary event, now may not be the best time to jump in because, again, the only bad time to flip houses is when the market's going down. And I think right now I don't expect a downturn, but I think we're probably more at risk of one now than we were 3 or 5 or 8 years ago.
Let me jump in and do another. I want to go back to the most costly thing. You can look back over the last 10 years, 13 years. Why was it that you said you were early on, you're meeting with a guy, and he says, this is the most costly thing. I wish I would have done this. You heard that. And then even still now, you found yourself kind of falling into the same trap. Well, is there anything you can point to and you're like, man, this is why that was so hard for me?
Yeah, because we're all smarter than everybody else, right? we don't have to listen to anybody else's stories. We know more than they do. And yeah, it really boils down to my ego got in the way and me thinking that if I can make $30,000, $40,000 a flip and I can do this 50 times a year, that's got to be the best course of action. And I never really sat down to think about how the other side of real estate works. I mean, that's not true. We bought some rentals back in 2008, 9, 10, 11, 12. We'd hold them for a tenant or two and then realize we were managing our own rentals. And we'd realize this is just a pain in the butt.
Yep.
Hated managing rentals, hated finding tenants, hated dealing with maintenance issues, hated dealing with collecting rent. And so we would always like, as soon as a bad tenant left, we would sell it. And so we would buy 10 here and then sell them and then buy 15 there and then sell them. And so it never occurred to me that there was a better way to do it. It never occurred to me that I could make rentals more passive. And it never occurred to me that in addition to the $100, $200, $300 a month I was making in cash flow, there are a whole bunch of other advantages to owning cash flowing real estate. We always talk about cash flowing real estate. We don't use terms like amortizing real estate. But the fact of the matter is your tenants are paying down your loans. You're gaining principal every year. So that's another benefit in addition to cash flow. We don't refer to it as tax beneficial real estate, but real estate has a ton of tax benefits when you hold on to it long term. We don't typically refer to appreciating real estate, even though real estate tends to go up over time. Now, it may only go up at the rate of inflation. Last decade or two, it's gone up more, but there's other ways that you can generate appreciation through real estate. Doing renovation can help you appreciate real estate. So we always talk. Yeah.
Well, no, I was just, you know, you said inflation only goes up at the rate of inflation at today's rates, that would be pretty good.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, real estate's always been a great hedge against inflation because historically rates or values have gone up about the same rate as inflation. So it is a great hedge. And if you have a lot of cash that you're using for flipping and it's sitting in the bank half the time because you haven't deployed it, yeah, buy and hold real estate's a great hedge. But I mean, long story short, we talk about cash flowing real estate, but there's also three other major benefits of holding real estate. And again, that's the principal pay down, the tax benefits, and the appreciation.
Well, so let me dig into something. We haven't talked about this any way, shape, or form before the show, but I think there's something to this, and I'm going to go down a path. Just bear with me. You were at the time in an active real estate venture, flipping houses. And if you looked at your hourly rate of flipping those houses, there's no wonder that when you started doing rentals and realizing the amount of time and energy it took you to manage those properties became too costly and you're like, screw this, I got to get out of this. Like we got to get rid of this because I'm making hundreds of dollars an hour over here flipping these houses and only $100 over here on these rentals. There's no wonder if you're in that active income mindset, you're never going to think about going on this passive side. Is there something that you did or experienced that you're like, aha, wait a minute, I need to be thinking more in this passive mindset?
Yeah, I got burned out. I realized that I hated flipping houses. It was a chore. Wow. And I sat down and I said, okay, now I've got all this cash and it's not doing anything for me. Yeah, I made a lot of cash flipping houses, but I wasn't building wealth any longer. Now that I stopped flipping, the money stopped coming in. And so now I had to figure out, how do I keep that money coming in? And so, I mean, basically three ways to make money. You invest other money, you invest time, or you invest knowledge. And basically I had all this cash, so I needed to invest that. But I also wanted to figure out how I could invest all the knowledge that I had learned through flipping and all the other skills I had. And so I was so focused. What I've realized is people come to me all the time now and they say, hey, I want to get started in real estate. Should I flip houses or should I buy rentals? How should I start? And what I have to explain to them is those aren't comparable things. That's kind of like saying, should I go to the movies or should I go out to dinner? They're two different things. They satisfy different needs. And same with flipping and rentals. We need to have some type of transactional income in our lives. We need to be trading our time for money, unless we're independently wealthy or trust fund. We need to figure out something to trade our time for money. A lot of us have a W-2 job. We go to a 9-to-5, or we are consultants, or we start a small business, or we do whatever. We trade our time for money. That's transactional. And flipping houses is transactional. Then if we're smart, we're taking at least some of that money that we're making through our trading time for money, we're taking some of that money and we're putting it into passive investments, things where our money is making money for us. And that could be buying notes, that could be buying cash flowing real estate, it could be investing in other passive income sources that are generating cash for us. And so we need to be doing both of these things, the transactional that generates us cash and then the passive that takes that cash and grows it. And so when people say, should I be flipping houses or buying rentals? What I say is, figure out what your transactional income should be, your time for money, what you're trading your time for money, and then figure out what your passive should be. And maybe it's flipping is your transactional and rentals is your passive, or maybe working a W-2 job is your transactional and buying notes is your passive, or whatever, mix and match any way you want, but don't say flipping or rentals, because they're very different things and they satisfy very different needs in your financial life.
This podcast is amazing, almost too amazing, Russ. There's too many ideas and I don't know where to get started creating passive income.
Well, here's the thing, Joey. I think one of the things you need to consider in that statement is, what is it costing you to not know? What is it costing you not to take action? I love the statement that says you don't have to be great to start. You just have to start to be great.
If you're struggling on where to start, you have to know what type of investor you are. Know your investor DNA. And if you want to learn more about this, you can join us in our Passport Challenge at wealthwithoutwallstreet.com/passport. Get started today.
So right, I got don't ask you more questions, Joey. I got an idea and it's gonna be gone.
I won't stand in front of the idea guy. Go ahead.
All right. So this is, I know, not an original idea. I just don't remember someone telling it to me before. So I'm going to throw this out there and let's solve this together. I wonder if there's a way, right? Like you mentioned flipping over 400 houses and clearly the regret was, what if I could have kept those? But the obstacle standing in your way is, I needed that transactional income. I needed that income to live off of. I needed that income to give me the ability to go do the next one, the next one, the next one. What if, right? Here's the big what if. What if I could have, come to you as you were doing the first home and I said, Jay, you know what? I want rental property. Like, I want as many rental properties as you can give me. And now, and I am just, the guinea pig in this, clearly the Black Rocks, the evil empire of the world, they'll take as many rental properties as you can give them, right? That's never going to be an issue, right? They're going to always do that.
Yep.
Well, what if when you did that first property, you could say, you know what, I'm just going to make up a number. I could sell it to you at 40,000, you know, and get my 40,000 out, or I could sell it to you for 35 and I keep a 10% equity stake in the property and profit on the rental property. So I get 35K and go to the next deal, right? And I constantly keep a little small equity stake in every single property that me, the investor, is going to turn into a rental property. I'm going to manage, I'm going to deal with all the stuff that goes with that. You're off to the races, but yet you now have 10% ownership in every one of those 400 rental properties and 10% ownership in the rental income from every one of those properties.
So we haven't talked about this either off camera or since this discussion started, but you've kind of hit on my philosophy of life. And it's kind of the way that I have chosen to build wealth over the years, mostly outside of real estate. It's funny because it didn't occur to me that's a great model inside of real estate as well until a couple of years ago. But I'm going to use a fancy term in the investing world, in the entrepreneurial world. We have this thing called a cap table or a capitalization table. And basically what a cap table is for a business or an investment, it's a list of all of the people that are investors or owners in that business. So if you look at let's take a tech company, Uber. If you look at Uber, so you look at the cap table for Uber, the founders probably own 10 or 15 or 20% of the stock. And then some of the big venture capital firms might own 30 or 40 or 50% of the stock. And then maybe the guy that lent the founders like $20,000 like the first month the company was founded, they might own a 0.5% or 1%. And so there are all these people on this capitalization table or this cap table, the list of all the owners in this thing. And whether you're talking about a business, whether you're talking about an investment, whether you're talking about anything that has value, there's the equivalent of this cap table. There's equivalent of this ownership table. And kind of my philosophy in life is figure out how to get on as many cap tables as I can get onto. Figure out how I can get a percentage ownership in as many different things in my life that I can possibly get ownership in. So whether it's startups, so I do angel investing and I invest in businesses, whether it's real estate, so I invest in syndications and I invest money in other people's deals and I partner in deals, whether it's crazy things like I own racehorses. So I own a piece of like a dozen thoroughbred racehorses. And
would
so
you say those are stallions, Jay?
Some of them are stallions, yes.
Okay, continue. I'm sorry, just to ask.
I go through life attempting to collect pieces of equity in as many different things as I can, and that's how I build wealth. And at the end of the day, what I tell people is, be a collector. Don't collect Beanie Babies. Maybe collect Beanie Babies. I don't know. But don't necessarily like collect like stuff you don't need. If you want to be a collector, collect equity in things. And I go through life trying to collect as much equity as I can in as many different things. If you were to look at my personal financial statement or my personal balance sheet, you would see about 100 different things listed where I have 1% equity here or 3% equity there or 12% equity there. Or maybe I'm a partner in some real estate where I'm not doing any work and I have 30 or 50% equity in that and I have 8% equity over here. And basically my personal financial statement is just a list of all of the different things, all the different cap tables that I have equity in. And so at the end of the day, I'm constantly asking myself, is this something worth having an equity stake in? And if the answer is yes, how do I get an equity stake in that thing? And that's basically what my days consist of right now. Is figuring out what's worth owning and figuring out how I can own a piece of it.
All right, but hold on.
No. Hold on 1 second. Dang, I'm going to ask one follow-up question to that. And then, because I don't know if your follow-up is on this. So here's one question that did come to my mind with that. In your small ownership in all of those different businesses, how are you limiting your downside? How are you protecting the liability that might come, whether that is having to pony up, you know, there being some sort of assessment, there being some sort of legal issue that comes to it? How do you protect yourself from the potential downside of being an owner in all of those different deals?
No pun intended on the pony up.
Just the same. So for every deal, I'm going to structure that deal in a way that makes sense for me. So for a lot of these deals, I'm a limited partner or I'm a non-capital partner. So for example, let's step back. To kind of answer that question, there are three ways to get equity in something, in everything. There are one of three ways or multiple three ways. And it's basically investing your time, your money, or your experience or knowledge. And so if you want to get an equity stake in something, you need to invest time, money, or knowledge. And so, for example, I started my career in the tech industry. And instead of going to work for a big company, I ended up working for a big company, but that's because my company got bought. I found a startup. And instead of taking a big salary, I said, I'm going to take the smallest salary as you give me, but give me as much equity as you can. Give me stock options. And so I started out my career in the tech industry. I had to go through a couple startups, but I finally got to a startup that was willing to give me a little equity. We got bought by Microsoft for $1 billion. So now suddenly I had this tiny little piece of equity in the startup company, but when your company gets bought for $1 billion, a tiny little piece is worth a little bit of money. So I traded my time. Literally, I was working 40, 50, 60, 70 hours a week. So then I had a little bit of money. Now I could start trading my money for equity. I could start buying into syndications. So I knew some smart real estate people who were buying these really big 20, 50, $100 million deals. And I was making a $50,000 investment there into their deals. I was trading my money for equity. And as I got good in real estate, I started writing books. And I started doing a lot of deals and I met a lot of people. And now suddenly I have got a lot of knowledge. And now that I have a lot of knowledge, I have these companies. I have this very specialized set of knowledge where I know tech and I know real estate. And a lot of people don't have that tech and real estate knowledge that overlap. But there are a lot of companies out there. Think of Airbnb, think of all the Zillows, all those tech companies that do real estate, that they are always looking for people that know that space. So I sit on a bunch of advisory boards for these tech companies that look for somebody that knows both tech and product and real estate. What do they give me in return for sitting on their advisory board? They give me equity. And so now I'm trading my knowledge for equity. So through my life, gotcha. I figure out, can I trade my time for equity? Can I trade my money for equity? Can I trade my experience for equity? And I figure out the right trade. And if it's something that I'm willing to take a financial risk in, I might trade my money. So I might go in as a partner on a big real estate deal. Then I'm putting my money at risk. But if there's something where I'm not really willing to invest in this company, but I believe in it enough that I want some equity, well, maybe I'll trade my experience. I'll get advisory shares where if the company loses all their money, I don't lose anything except the time and the effort I spent. And so, yes, sometimes you have to risk. Sometimes there's downside, but there are other ways to gain equity where there's really no downside other than your time and your energy.
Well, and Russ asked a terrible question. You gave a great answer. I appreciate it. But my question is so much better in light of your whole point about equity. And that is, if I would be remiss, if we're on the show of Wealth Without Wall Street, teaching people how to create financial freedom through their passive income, exceeding their monthly expenses, how do you think about that equity share? Or does your equity share equate to a consistent passive income? Is that part of your buy box? Or are you, in many cases, trading these things for equity that you hope will come, like an appreciation or, you know, some down the road thing? Or is there always immediate cash flow associated with it?
So for me, like I said, I'm very fortunate. I respect all those people that will come on and say, yeah, I started with 2 cents in my pocket and I had to bootstrap and all that. I was very fortunate. Yeah, I grew up very poor, but I worked my way through college and then I got very fortunate in the tech world and made some money. So when I quit my job, I was able to say, hey, if I don't make an income for 6 or 12 months, I'm okay. And as long as I have some income coming in, I don't need the immediate cash flow. So for me, cash flow wasn't as much of a priority as it is for a lot of people. That said, obviously cash flow is still important. So for me, I for every time I invest, again, whether it's my time, my money, or my experience, I'm thinking about what's the likelihood this is going to pay off, at what rate is this going to pay off, and in what time frame is it going to pay off. So I've invested in some stuff where I expect no cash flow. I expect very low chance of it having a big payoff. But if there is a payoff, I'm not putting that much into it, and it's a potentially a huge payoff. I know a bunch of people that got in early at companies like Uber and Airbnb because they happen to know people in the industry that were working on companies like this. They went and they put $10,000 in. That $10,000 was eventually worth $10 million. And what was the chances of that happening? Very low. But sometimes you want to make those big bets. If you can put a little bit of money in for a potentially huge reward down the road, yeah, it's gambling. But for any portfolio, a little bit of gambling, a little bit of long shot is not necessarily a bad thing. You don't want to put 50% of your portfolio into long shots, but maybe you put 1 or 2 or 3% of your portfolio in long shots. Then there are other things where you don't want the long shot. You don't want a shot at a 50 or 100 or a 5,000% return. You're happy just to get your 8, 9, 10% return. And that's where you're going to take your money and you're going to buy a rental property, or you're going to go and invest in a syndication if you want to be completely passive. You're not going to make 50% or 100% returns because those types of investments don't generate those kinds of returns, but you're going to get the consistent cash flow early. So for all of us, we need to kind of look at our portfolio and say, how much cash flow do I need out of my portfolio? Do I have a full-time job? Do I have another source of income? If the answer is no, then you probably need more cash flow. If the answer is, yeah, I love my job, I'm going to be doing this for the next 20 years, my goal is to have cash flow in 20 years, well, then you can model your portfolio differently. So we all have to kind of look at what our needs are short-term and long-term, what our risk tolerance is short-term and long-term, what our time horizon is. If I only have 5 years until retirement, I'm probably going to need to take some bigger risks than if I have 30 or 40 years until retirement. Or maybe you look at it the other way. If you have 30 or 40 years till retirement, you can take some big risks. So everybody has to look at their own portfolio and figure out what are the right investments, what's the right type of equity, what are the right type of things to have in your portfolio that specifically suit your needs and your future needs.
Well, and that, I appreciate that perspective on it, Jay, because everybody has a different one and we don't pretend to have the one size fits all model. And the thing that Joey and I always push back on, I would be remiss if I didn't push back on it here just to get your opinion to it. And I don't know, you know, when you're on and in the forums within Bigger Pockets, the nature of the conversations, but the nature in our community is I want out of my job as soon as possible, right? So the absolute objective that they have is to stop trading time for money as fast as possible.
Yep.
And so we feel like that's our duty. Like we're here with the sword, you know, and the shield, and we're saving the world from saving time, from spending time, you know, trading time for money for the rest of our life. Like that's our objective. So like when we hear years to retirement and all of that stuff, we like, no, you don't have to do that. Like that's not the model, right? But also we say that there is a hierarchy of wealth. It's not new to us or original to us, but we use it to say, you know, speculation is at the top. It's the last thing. It's the self-actualization in the equivalent to Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right?
Yep.
Speculation and all of those things. And I heard you say the same thing. It's not the thing you would put your first dollar into. It's the last thing, right? And once you've gotten to financial freedom, which that's where you are, when you got financial freedom and your passive income is greater than your monthly expenses, you've done things in an area of control and collateral that you can influence the outcome of, and you have extra money. Like Joey and I have been angel investors in private companies because we believed in the mission, right? We believed in the opportunity. And yeah, hey, look, if it 100x is in the future, great. But that's not like, we don't think of it as that's where our money is. Like some people look at crypto that way. They think, well, Bitcoin is going to be 500,000 or a coin in 15 years. I just want to own one coin, right? So I can have 500,000. We don't think of it that way. So there's a different perspective. I love that you say that. But most of the people that are listening to the show are thinking, how do I get the cash flow? How do I get to that point as fast as possible? And clearly you've done a really good job of kind of laying out what you thought of as saying, hey, there's transactional income and that pays the bills today. Don't be so short-sighted in that process. Think long-term. Think ways to create passive income streams all over the place. And all of that just leads to more opportunities. Well, I knew we were going to run out of time. Here we are at the half hour. So I want to like point listeners to who want to find out more about you. Clearly, we're going to have you in the community. Have you, you know, being able to ask Jay questions and pick his brain. But if somebody wanted to go outside of that to connect with you, figure out what you're doing and what you're up to, where would they go to?
Yeah, absolutely. So these days, my focus is on very large multifamily. So we're buying apartment complexes, $20, $50 million apartment complexes. That's kind of my focus these days. And for anybody that wants to find out more about what I'm doing, get in touch with me. You can go to www.connectwithjscott, just the letter J, scott.com. Connectwithjscott.com.
Perfect. Perfect. Well, Jay, this is, man, I feel like we got just doused with wisdom over your years of hopefully not too many bumps and bruises, but man, just people that can look back and say, okay, this is a route to financial freedom. And what can I take away from that? So, man, thank you for being willing to come on and share your wisdom with us on the show.
Hey, I appreciate you guys having me.
As always, thank you for listening to the Wealth Without Wall Street podcast. If you found value today, if you would share, like, comment, rate, and review us. That's how other people find this great content. And we will see you on the next episode.
This has been the Wealth Without Wall Street podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to the show to break free of the Wall Street mindset and begin building wealth on your own terms in places you understand, so that your wealth will never run dry. See you next episode.